This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, good afternoon. Michelle Stanley with you for the Country Hour this Friday. Happy Gravy Day. Great to share your company to end the week. And the review into the Albany bushfires earlier this year was released yesterday afternoon. Once again, communication, or the lack thereof, seems to be the big sticking point. You'll get the details and reactions to this review before the news at 1 o'clock. And off to Mora today, where some happy parents are celebrating an early Christmas present. More on that shortly. We'll have some bushfire information for you in about 15 minutes, so stick around. I'll be with you until 1 o'clock, 0448 922 604, if you want to get in touch. First up, though, if I was going to ask how much money you think a charity makes each year, what would your guess be? The reason I ask is the numbers have been crunched on one animal rights group that's been pretty topical this year, Animals Australia, and the income is probably more than you think. Andrew Whitelaw is a senior commodity analyst from Mercado. He looked through Animal Australia's financial reports this week and was surprised by the results.
So when we look at it, 2018, which is the last set of accounts, and that was in a period when they've had that live export issue in Western Australia. They received in that particular year $9.3 million.
That's a fair sum. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, I knew it was going to be high and a lot of money. I didn't realise it would be 9.3, so that was a bit of a surprise. And I guess when you look at what they've received, I've just looked back to 2013. And since 2013, they've received $45 million or thereabouts.
Are you able to, or have you done the stats on any other kinds of groups to put that into perspective?
No, I was curious about it, and I think I just haven't had spare time. And it would be interesting to see, well, how does that compare with our lobby groups, the likes of WA Farmers, Pastoralists and Graziers, NFF, etc. But you know, 9.3 million or 45 million over the past 5 or 6 years is a lot of money, and I don't think many of them would really compare to that.
You've also looked into the actual campaign spending by Animals Australia against live export. What did that find?
Well, that was quite interesting. Animals Australia have been quite forthcoming, and they've actually, in their annual report, they've separated their spending into a number of different areas. And so their spending on campaigning against live export over the past 2 years, so 2017-2018, is at $6 million. So that's a lot of money just to be campaigning against one sole focus. And then they've also spent over the last 2 years close to $4 million on what they call campaigns for farmed animal welfare. It's not quite specific about what they actually have spent that money on, but looking at their work in the past, I imagine it's most likely things like pigs, chooks, eggs and dairy.
Andrew Whitelaw is a senior commodity analyst with Mercado. He's found Animals Australia had an annual income of $9.3 million in 2018. And over the last 2 years, about $6 million went directly into anti-live export campaigning. Now, to put that into perspective, Tony Seabrook is the president of the Pastoralists and Graziers Association of WA, and he joins you. Tony, what's your reaction to these figures?
Michelle, I think we've known that for quite a long time. The assault they've mounted against the live export industry has been unrelenting, and the capacity for us as an industry to tell our story is almost non-existent. They've done a real job on us, and they've denied us the opportunity to actually present our case.
In comparison, what would a group like PGA be earning in a 12-month period?
Oh, Michelle, look, we are dwarfed, absolutely dwarfed, both the WA Farmers Federation and the PGA, by that amount of money. Our organisation is advocate on behalf of agriculture over a broad range of issues. And so a lot of export has come out of nowhere. It's been probably the biggest thing on our table in the last 12 months. It's consumed an enormous amount of time. And look, the disappointing thing is that I don't think that the general sort of sheep industry has any concept of the risk that we're under. They seem to feel that because the trade is now up and running, it's going to be okay. It's not going to be okay. With the implementation of the heat stress model that's come forward, we are on the absolute cusp of losing this trade, and we'll lose it for all the wrong reasons.
Are you able to let us know exactly how much, or a rough idea of how much less PGA would bring in each year compared to this $9.3 million from Animals Australia?
We wouldn't even be one-tenth of that. Not even a tenth of it. We are fighting a massive battle, and we are so under-resourced. And the biggest problem we've got is that politicians consider to stand up and say they're against live export as a vote-winning exercise. While they consider it to be a vote-winning exercise, we are in really serious trouble. And we've got a really good story to tell. The mortality levels coming through on current voyages, minute. You know, we're down to something like a quarter of 1%, which is basically what farmers lose on farm over that period of time. The independent observers on these ships, the destocking as a result of the McCarthy report. You know, we've got a fantastic story to tell, and we're just not being given the opportunity to do that. We need resourcing, and it's a great disappointment that the broader sort of farming community, the sheep industry, has not seen fit to step up and do something to protect their own interests.
In the last 2 years, Animals Australia has put about $6 million into anti-live export campaigns alone and about $3.8 million into farmed animal campaigns exclusively as well. In comparison, your pro-live export campaign, what would the spend have been on that?
Oh, it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, we don't have the capacity. You know, the request I made, and I don't think it was unreasonable, was for every sheep producer that sold a sheep last year to contribute $1 to a fund to protect their industry. Now, on the sale value of $100, and live export sheep right now are bringing about $120, but on the sale value of $100, you're paying 5% commission to the stock firm. That's $5 out of the $100. The request I made was for people to step up and contribute $1 for every animal they sold last year. Now, that would have given us a fund in excess of $4 million. That would have been a very, very useful amount of money to do something to actually tell our story. The levies that are being extracted from the industry, especially the MLA levy, there's $100 million sitting there. It can't be used to advocate, which is a great shame. But if you've just sold 1,000 wethers to go live export and the MLA levy has been extracted, I'm quite certain that you'd rather see that levy spent to protect your industry against the assault that it's coming under rather than going to research, because all the research in the world won't be any good if there isn't an industry.
$45 million has been donated to Animals Australia in the last 5 years. It's a significant number. Surely that shows quite a clear support of the anti-live export movement. Isn't it time for groups like PGA and WA Farmers to seriously consider other markets?
Look, we are organisations that advocate on behalf of industry. We're not into marketing. It's not what we do. We just advocate on behalf of industry, and we do what we can to protect industry. What people need to understand is that the people within these organisations, they're not just about banning live export. They're about bringing about a fundamental change across the whole length and breadth of the industry, stock industry. Now, whether we're talking pigs, chickens, or sheep, they're putting together reports on sale yards. They're taking photographs of stocking densities in sale yards. They'll move into trucks. If anyone thinks it's about live sheep, you can forget that. As the heat stress model starts to unfold, it will be applied to cattle. If these activists actually manage to encourage or cajole government into enforcing the regulations in the way they'd like to see them enforced, it will bring about such a fundamental change that people that are deriving income from livestock production right now will wonder what on earth happened to them.
Tony Seabrook, President of the PGA of WA, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today. Now, if you've got a reaction to these figures, get in touch 0448 922 604. Bruce from Broome has sent a text saying, the Animals Australia campaign shows the need for WAF and PGA to unite. Thanks for your text, Bruce. 0448 922 604 if you've got something to add. Now, from one Tony to another, Tony York is the president of the WA Farmers Federation. Tony York, what's your greatest concern from the stats released by Mercado earlier this week?
Look, it's just such a large amount of money, really, and probably the narrowness that they have chosen to apply the advertising campaign in. I mean, it is the live export trade and the intensive agricultural animals. I mean, there's plenty of other issues that I think they could have put some resources into, so it is alarming, but it does show you the extent of support that that organisation has. They're not the only ones, but... Has on clearly what they see as a very emotive issue, and that they're drawing funds and spending them where they think they can get more funds from, I suspect.
Having that support financially across Australia on such a political issue, does it concern you going into an election year?
Definitely. That's 2018, no election. We had the misfortune of the Wassey Express incident coming up, which is, you know, very serious concerns, and gave them a focus to launch that campaign on. And I can assure everybody that I'm very confident that they'll be making sure that that issue becomes an election issue going into 2019. And it's likely that we're going to see another increase in their campaign going up to that election. I mean, you have got the Labor Party already standing on a policy of transition over 5 years. So it's not surprising that, and I think we have to expect that that campaign is going to be part of the election process.
In comparison, we spoke with Tony Seabrook from the PGA, who said the PGA receives not even 10% of the income Animals Australia did in 2018. What would it be for WA farmers?
Our total income is a little bit under $2 million, so significantly less, and we can't commit all of it for advertising campaigns. We've, you know, got the whole gamut of all other issues that we want to deal with in advocacy for agriculture. So absolutely, we're on the back foot in terms of trying to, what we can afford in terms of campaigning. We just have to not smother the airwaves with advertising. We just can't afford it. If we could, it might help, but really we have to continue to propagate the argument that we've got a legitimate business and it can be run meeting, you know, acceptable high animal welfare standards. I mean, we can't defend the exceptional events that are clearly indefensible. So we have to accept and work that they have happened and work on trying to make sure they don't happen again. And I think there's been a lot of work done, particularly with the current federal government, with a lot of initiatives, and some will argue maybe they'll go too far in terms of regulations and controls, but that absolutely the industry, with the support of the government now, and the regulators, is to try and reassure the public that these outcomes, as reflected with the Awassi Express, will never happen again.
Tony York from the WA Farmers Federation, thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
No worries. Thanks, Michelle. And it's nearly Christmas, so can I wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And let's hope 2019 is a prosperous year for us all.
And for you too. Thanks, Tony. It's 18 past 12 on the Country Hour. 0448 922 604 if you want to get in touch, just as Charles has done. He says, well, it shows people care for animals in Australia. Another texter says, Belinda, Animals Australia just want farmers to stop selling and supplying meat full stop. That includes on-farm production for local markets as well. Producers will have to cooperate on the live trade. Michelle Stanley with you. Not Belinda today. I'll be with you for the next few weeks. But thanks for getting in touch. 0448 922 604. Now, I've contacted Animals Australia. Being this time of year, unfortunately, no one was available to chat. But in a statement, it said the income generated through donations to Animals Australia reflects the depth of community concern about animal welfare issues, especially the desire to see an end to the live export trade and cruel production practices such as the Battery hen cage. It said our supporter base is very happy with the way Animals Australia spends the funds provided to us for these purposes. It's been acknowledged by the Moss Review that the primary enforcement of systems such as SCAS has been done by Animals Australia and that we have by default actively become part of the regulatory machine of the live export trade. This is a position that a charity should never have been forced into. Your thoughts on 0448 922 604. Michelle Stanley with you on the Country Hour. It's 20 past 12.
ABC Radio, bushfire information.
And Lily Hoffman joins me in the studio with some information on the fire in the Shire of Jarramungup. Lily?
Thanks, Michelle. A bushfire watch and act has been issued for people bounded by Borden and Bremer Bay Road to the north, Warramurrup Road to the east, the coastline to the south and Reef Beach Road to the west in the western part of Bremer Bay and the eastern part of Boxwood Hill in the Shire of Jarramungup. The alert level for this fire has been upgraded and there is a possible threat to lives and homes as the fire is approaching in the area and conditions are changing. You need to leave or get ready to actively defend. If you're not prepared or your plan to leave, leave now if the way is clear. If you are well prepared and plan to actively defend your home, make final preparations now. If you're not at home, do not try to return as conditions in the area could be very dangerous. Close all doors and windows and turn off evaporative air conditioners, but keep water running through the system if possible. The bushfire is moving in a southwesterly direction. It is contained but not controlled. There are a number of roads that have been closed, including Reef Beach Road and Warramurrup Road. Firefighters are on the scene actively fighting the fire. Aerial support has been sent to assist ground crews, and on that, never fly a drone, model aircraft or multi-rotor near bushfires. Doing so forces aircraft to be grounded or redirected, hindering firefighting efforts.
Thanks for that, Lillian. We'll have more information on that watch and act at about 12:45. It's 21 past 12 on the Country Hour.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
To some positive news now, and after a year of tireless campaigning, funding to save Mora College has officially been signed off. The state and federal governments yesterday signed off on an $8.7 million funding package to refurbish the college. Ken Seymour is the Mora Shire president. He says the news comes as a relief.
It means quite a bit for the community. We were quite concerned that with a upcoming federal election looming, this may get lost in the bureaucratic process, but it's been signed off, so our community and region is more than happy that the deed has actually been signed.
And this concept was originally, you know, it was announced on September 4th that the funding would be coming through, but the signing off of it, the actual red tape of it, hadn't happened yet. What does it mean, that waiting period? How did that feel with that sort of not knowing if it get through, particularly before Christmas?
Yeah, we were quite anxious. So we're delighted that it's finally happened. The whole community was sort of on tenterhooks, I think, because of what had happened before. We'd been promised it and it disappeared. So more than happy that it's finally been signed.
Can you believe it, that they've come through this time?
Yes, I can, because we've had quite a bit of sort of contact back and forth with the federal and state departments. So we've been sort of knowing that it's getting closer and closer, but actually to be finally signed, great news.
So will this mean that the Mora Residential College, the doors will be open with the start of the school year next year?
It certainly will. And there's plans out there at the moment for the new building of up to 50 beds for students. And once that happens, we look forward to trying to fill all of those beds.
And the Mora Residential College, the campaign you've run to keep that open, the community has run, I feel like most people in WA probably would have heard about it by now. You were very vocal. What went into a campaign like that to be able to make something that is a local community issue become almost a national campaign?
Yeah, it was a lot of hard work and we had to sort of invent some new ideas and on how to get the community behind us. And I think we're able to achieve that through the help of a number of people and working with the media and getting people on side. It was challenging, but I think we sort of set some new ground.
And have you spoken to any of the parents of students that rely on the residential college in the wake of this news?
I certainly have, and they're delighted.
Mora Shire President Ken Seymour having a chat with Lily Hoffman. And one of those delighted parents is Deb Richards. She's been campaigning to save Mora College for her son, River, who has just completed Year 10.
Absolutely fantastic. It's just fantastic. It's a happy, happy Christmas this year compared to last year, which wasn't due to the announcement. So, it's just been wonderful.
And for your son, River, he's in Year 10. Would he be going into Year 11 now?
Yes, yep. It was great. When we heard about the funding, we actually rang him up and we said, oh, guess where you're going to be next year? And he said, right here. So it was great.
And I can imagine, I mean, for River at his age and going to the school, it would have been rather disruptive not knowing if you'd be there next year or the year after even. What do you think it means for him and for your family knowing exactly where he's going to be next year and that he can be settled?
It means so much because it did disrupt not just him but a lot of the children at the hostel. And his grades suffered as a result. And when it came to the end of the year, he realised how much his grades had dropped. And that sort of disappointed him even more. But we've agreed we're just going to let this year slide and we're going to start a fresh new year. And he's going to work hard to get back to where he was. So it just means so much in that he can actually focus on his studies, which is what he should have been doing this year.
Mm. And have you spoken to any of the other parents of children at the residential college after the news?
Only a couple, and it actually meant so much more for them because they're out on properties and the distance is obviously a lot greater to other facilities. And, just to have it open has just made a world of difference to them. A big, big thank you to everybody who supported this cause all through the year. I can't tell you how much. You're all in my heart. And, just thank you so much.
What a lovely Christmas present for Deb Richards. She's the mother to River, who will be boarding at the Mora Residential College next year. The funding officially signed off from state and federal government, $8.7 million of funding to refurbish the Mora Residential College. And Deb Richards was chatting with Lily Hoffman. And the state government says it's committed to providing the necessary ongoing recurrent funding to keep the college open. So some good news for parents in or who use the Mora Residential College right around the state. I believe there are even some families up in the Pilbara who send their kids down to Mora. 0448 922 604 if you want to get in touch with any of the topics we're talking about today. We were speaking earlier about Animals Australia's annual income. Mercado has crunched the numbers and found Animal Australia has an annual income of $9.3 million for 2018. That's up $45 million across the last 5 years. And over the last 2 years, about $6 million went directly into anti-live export campaigning. Chris from Albany has texted in to ask how much of that Animals Australia funding has come from overseas. We're not too sure, Chris, but we'll try and find out for you. If you have any comments, 0448 922 604. We'll check in with the news headlines very shortly and the Bureau of Meteorology to get, well, not the last wrap-up before Christmas, but certainly a wrap-up of the weather for the state ahead of the weekend and Christmas, obviously Christmas Eve on Monday, Christmas Day on Tuesday. Looks like it's going to be pretty warm. After a check-in with the news headlines, we'll be off to Manjimup to chat about the cherry season. I know that's something I like to have on my Christmas table, some nice cherries. But also, the Office of Bushfire Risk Management has released its report into the escaped burns in the Stirling Range National Park, those Albany bushfires from, I think, May this year. We'll find out a little bit more about what's been in that report after a check-in with the Bureau of Meteorology in just a couple of minutes.
G'day, this is Colin Briley from Indy Station and you're listening to the Country Hour of the ABC.
Now, do you have a message to new budding station workers?
Go and work on a mine. You get paid more.
Absolute crack up, Colin Brierley. We'll hear from him a little bit more on Monday and find out what he's up to at Indy Station for Christmas Day. But Vicky Saleur joins me in the studio now for some news headlines. Vicky?
Thank you. In the news, a funding agreement to save Mora Residential College has been finalised, ending more than a year of uncertainty with the state and federal governments officially signing off on the terms and conditions for an $8.7 million funding package to upgrade the college. Three Northern Territory government members have been sacked after public criticism by them this week of Labor's handling of the Territory's budget. A damning audit released on Friday last week showed the Territory budget was in major structural deficit. A spokeswoman for the government has confirmed that Aboriginal Affairs and Resources Minister Ken Vowles has been stripped of his portfolios, and the ABC understands Assistant Minister Jeff Collins and backbencher Scott McConnell have also been dismissed. And overseas, China has described US allegations that it's engaged in mass hacking as extremely nasty and purely fictitious. The US Department of Justice has named two Chinese nationals it accuses of stealing secrets from more than 45 American companies as well as the US military. And I'll be back with more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Vicky.
Thank you.
12:30 on the Country Hour. Rabi Rivette joins me from the Bureau of Meteorology to look at the state over the weekend. Rabi, how are things looking in the Southwest Land Division for the next few days?
We've got a trough near the west coast at the moment, some thunderstorm activity firing away sort of in the northern, far northern central west at the moment, or if not, about to move into there, and that'll sort of continue for the rest of today. And then that activity extends a bit further south extends a bit further south on Saturday and again on Sunday. So by Sunday, we're looking at some thunderstorm activity through the central west, far northern parts of the central wheat belt, and then also potentially some thunderstorm activity down across the great southern and eastern parts of the south coastal. As the early next week, thunderstorm activity continuing sort of inland from the west coast through the Gascoyne and far northern central wheat belt, and then persisting through there on Christmas Day through the central west, and central wheat belt. We could also see a slight chance of a shower sort of on the west and south coast, sort of near the Albany area on Monday and Tuesday morning, although very little rainfall expected in that.
And how about for northern and eastern forecast districts?
Well, it's pretty hot. We had a couple more December records fall yesterday. So Doongan and Cullumbaroo recorded their hottest December day on record, and that looks to be continuing. So we're sort of in, I suppose, severe to extreme heatwave conditions through the Kimberley at the moment, and then basically as we go into next week, that's extending through most of the northeastern part of the state. So with severe sort of heatwaves, and climatologically up there is traditionally quite hot. So when we're talking severe heatwaves, we're talking even hotter than, quite a lot hotter than normal, which could pose some problems for the people up that way.
Yeah, how as far hot was that record? Sorry to intro. How hot was the record they broke?
It wasn't super hot, but I think it was just that those sites don't usually. I mean, Clumber is right on the coast. I think it was in the low 40s, and so 43, which is pretty hot for there, and Doongan, which has had, we've got 30 years of data, and that was 42 degrees. So not super hot. I mean, during December, I suppose, in those areas, you're generally looking at cloudy thunderstorm activity and sort of clouds to suppress the heat a bit. And that, I suppose, joins a few other records that have been broken in the Kimberley this month.
Yeah, pretty warm, though, still.
Yes. when we're talking marble bars, sort of, 40-plus for months on end, relative to that, it's a tiny bit cooler, but still pretty hot.
And so pretty hot going into the Christmas week as well, I'd say.
By the sort of basically the whole northeastern part of the state is pretty much above 40 degrees. So, and that extends down into, I suppose, northeastern parts of the Southwest Land Division as well.
And any warnings about today?
We've just got some fire weather warnings for the this is a long list. We've got the coastal central west, the interior, Kimberley inland, east Pilbara coast, east Pilbara inland, and inland central west north. And generally, hot conditions and a bit windy.
Thanks so much for your time, Rabi Rivette from the Bureau of Meteorology, the duty forecaster for today. I hope you have a lovely Christmas. And looking at the rainfall around the state, just one total over 5 mils to 9 o'clock today. In the Kimberley, it was Marion Downs, which saw 22 mils fall. Not a bad sprinkle, but hopefully a lot more to come this wet season. It's about 25 to 1.
ABC Radio, fire ban information.
Ravi mentioned some of those severe fire forecasts around the state, and the Department of Fire and Emergency Services has issued a total fire ban for parts of the Midwest Gascoyne today. That's for the local government districts of Chapman Valley, Greater Geraldton and Northampton. At these times, you must not light, maintain or use a fire in open air or carry out any activity that could start a fire. This includes all open fires for the purpose of cooking or camping, hot work such as metalwork, grinding, welding, soldering, gas cutting or similar. It's not allowed unless you have an exemption. And due to the risk of fire, there is also a harvest and vehicle movement ban for the Shire of Dandaragan. So that's a ban on harvesting and the use of any engines, vehicles, plant or machinery in paddocks. Contact your local shire for more information on the lifting of harvest bans. If that harvest and vehicle movement ban hasn't been implemented by your local government, you are able to harvest or move vehicles across paddocks for agricultural purposes. Now, you could be fined up to $25,000 or jailed for 12 months or both if you ignore the total fire ban. You can get more information on the total fire ban website. That's dfis.wa.gov.au/total-fire-bans or the total fire ban information line, 1800 709 355. There'll be more information on total fire bans and harvest bans at about 3:05 this afternoon. And also we'll have some information on the Watch and Act in the Shire of Gerramungup in about 10 minutes.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Heading down to Albany now and looking at yesterday afternoon, the Office of Bushfire Risk Management released its long-awaited report into the escaped burns in Stirling Range National Park earlier this year. The fire ravaged through 17,200 hectares. Including farmland. Now, the report noted the absence of effective communication with farmers, local volunteers, and senior fire control officers. Andrew Collins spoke to the Office of Bushfire Risk Management Director Tim McNaught yesterday afternoon.
What we found with the Stirling Ranges in particular, and because of the significance of the event and the unfortunate impact that that escape had on some people's livelihoods there, was that the communication was and the relationships were a lot less well-developed there. Also, I guess, a high turnover of staff in those particular areas and also large areas to manage and limited resourcing for some of those burns that need to be put in place. So I guess it highlighted the fact that local-level relationships are really important in those circumstances.
So is the report in essence saying that if the Parks and Wildlife had have consulted the locals on the ground, the burn would not have taken place?
Oh, not necessarily. No, I think that there might have been some... So certainly the DBCA in this circumstance did consult with the local government, the City of Albany, but not with the local senior fire control officer for whatever reason. And what we...
But is the reason because relationships weren't developed, as you pointed to before, or is there another reason?
No. I think it was an oversight that was identified and acknowledged by both parties there, for sure.
Okay, so what's being put in place, or what can be put in place, so that doesn't happen again?
Yeah, so certainly, DBCA have acknowledged, and the City of Albany acknowledged that there needs to be a better investment in relationships there, and I think it'd be fair to say that the Stirling Range locals will also be working on building those relationships as well, because both very focused on managing the risk of fire in the landscape to protect life and property. So outcomes want to be the same, just want to try and achieve it as safely and as effectively as possible.
Are those landowners due an apology, or has an apology been forthcoming?
Uh, oh, I'm not aware. I mean, certainly we met with them and listened to their concerns, and I think reflected some of those concerns in our report. And I understand that they've been in contact with our ministers as well, and certainly the DBCA have met with them numerous times.
Office of Bushfire Risk Management Director Tim McNaught speaking with Andrew Collins. Your thoughts are welcome on this review. 0448 922 604. We've had a text from Sebastian. I'm assuming that's anonymous. That bushfire report ignores the elephant in the room. The fact there is absolutely no reason why prescribed burning needs to be done in an isolated national park like the Stirling Ranges. No one lives within its boundaries, so no homes are threatened by naturally started fires, like naturally lighting started fires. I guess he means fire started by lightning. The only time property is threatened is when these controlled burns get out of control. These controlled burns cause the very damage they are supposed to prevent. For example, the destruction of pristine bush and wildlife. Bordering farms have their own mitigation measures. Thanks for your text, Sebastian, and you can send your comments through 0448 922 604. Well, South Stirling farmer Mal Thompson lost about 460 ewes and 900 hectares of his property due to this fire. He shared his thoughts on the report and Tim McNaught's comments with the ABC's John Daly.
I was surprised I was out this early. But haven't taken that long to get the report out. And I think the main thing he came up with was that we needed to be better communication between the farmers and the guides with Deepaw, who then known, they were known as Deepaw,
yeah.
Which was obvious.
As you mentioned there, the report noticed that effective communication with local volunteers and senior fire control officers, or the absence, I should say, of that effective communication meant local conditions weren't properly understood and support for planned burns was quite limited. Is that something that you experienced or saw firsthand on the ground?
Yeah, we did. We all knew that the weather was going to be not a very nice week. Plus, we did believe that the rain that they were forecasting wasn't coming straight after the front, and so everyone around here had stopped prescribed burning and were sitting and waiting. While the Stirling National Park was lit up on the Monday.
The question was put to Tim that, you know, following these findings, basically noting that there was really an absence of that communication between local farmers and whether it be the other parties, DBCA and the local shire. The question was asked whether those prescribed burns would have taken place if the knowledge, you know, with that knowledge in hindsight. And what did you make of Tim's response to that question?
It was probably the only thing I didn't like about the whole interview. He did state that it was unknown whether the prescribed burn would have gone ahead or not if they had consulted with the farmers and the local fire brigades, when it was obvious in my eyes, and I think the whole district's eyes, that we would have not allowed and certainly not backed them lighting the Stirlings on that week. And I believe it was quite obvious that it just wasn't a week to light up the Stirlings with the dryness of the ground, the strength of the winds and the warmth of that of those days was just a ridiculous thing to have done.
One of the key takeaways from this report is the importance of relationships. In this instance, that those relationships failed, that communication failed. So from your perspective, being a local farmer, how can that be fixed after all that's happened?
Well, I just think they just need to communicate with us, ring us up, get our point of view. We back onto the Stirling Ranges, and none of the farmers that actually got burnt from the fires, one did get consulted, and it wasn't really a consultant. It was He was told that they were lighting the Stirlings up. The other three farmers that got burnt weren't informed at all that the Stirlings were going to be lit up, and nor was our fire chief of any of the brigades around. So all they need to do is just communicate with us and get our opinion. Most of us have been here a fair while and do know the weather patterns that do come through, and it just needs to be, you know, the communication is one of those things that they can say that they will do it, but I've yet to see it in practice, but I haven't been to a fire since either.
Do you think there should be an apology?
I do believe they have said sorry for what had happened. I don't believe they've actually said sorry for lighting it. I think their hands are probably tied in actually stating that. So I'd like to get an official apology for the damage and everything that has happened to the people that did get burnt. But I think we'll just have to wait and see what happens there.
And Mel, it's been, what, 7 months since the fire. How has the recovery been at your place?
Oh, it's just been a slow progress over the last, I think it is nearly exactly 7 months. We've done a fair bit of fencing. The paddocks still need to be smoothed out a bit with some of the erosion. We've still got a lot of fencing to do, and a bit of tree lines and stuff that need to be cleaned up and all that. But I don't know. It's just one of those things that we'll get it finished eventually. But it's probably another year or so before we're able to actually put livestock back on that farm with the fences good enough to hold the livestock.
South Stirling farmer Mal Thompson speaking with John Daly. At 13 to 1 on the Country Hour, Michelle Stanley with you.
ABC Radio, bushfire information.
And Paul from Jacob has texted us a picture of smoke on the horizon. He says it's from the Bremer Bay fire. Talking about that, joining us in the studio now for more information on that fire is Lily Hoffman.
Thanks, Michelle. A bushfire watch and act has been issued for people bounded by Borden Bremer Bay Road to the north, Warramurrup Road to the east, the coastline to the south and Reef Beach Road to the west in the western part of Bremer Bay and the eastern part of Boxwood Hill in the Shire of Gerramungup. The alert level for this fire has been upgraded to a watch and act. There is a possible threat to lives and homes as a fire is approaching in the area and conditions are changing. You need to leave or get ready to actively defend. If you are not prepared or you plan to leave, leave now if the way is clear. If you are well prepared and plan to actively defend your home, make final preparations now. If you are not at home, do not try to return as conditions in the area could be very dangerous. Close all doors and windows and turn off evaporative air conditioners, but keep water running through the system if possible. The bushfire is moving in a southwesterly direction. It is contained but not controlled. A number of roads have been closed, including Reef Beach Road and Warramurrup Road. Firefighters are on the scene actively fighting the fire, and aerial support has been sent to assist ground crews. On aerial support, never fly a drone or model aircraft around or near a bushfire. Doing so forces aircrafts to be grounded or redirected, hindering firefighting efforts. You can keep up to date by listening right here on ABC Local Radio or call 13 DFIS 13337.
And we'll have more information on that bushfire at about 1:15. Thanks, Lily.
Thank you.
It's 12 to 1 o'clock. I'm getting a bit ahead of myself on the Country Hour.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Michelle Stanley with you. And researchers at the University of Western Australia are about to embark on a hunt for a new mode of action to kill weeds. And it's pretty important work because truly new herbicide modes of actions have emerged in about 20 years. And with resistance to current products growing, it's a race against time to find new ways for chemicals to kill off problem weeds. UWA Associate Professor Keith Stubbs says the project, which is called Putting New Herbicide Targets on the Table, aims to put more tools in the toolbox for Australia's broadacre farmers.
So I guess the overall aims of the grant are to basically find new types of herbicides and new chemical molecules as well that we can use on as herbicides, and also find new protein targets within the plant or the weed, more specifically, that we can then use as a herbicidal mode of action target in terms of once we know the target, we know that the weed is... It needs that protein to survive, and so we can develop molecules towards that mode of action.
So basically attacking that protein that the plant needs to survive once you identify it.
That's right.
Yeah. Why hasn't this been done before? It sounds so simple when you just say it like that, Keith.
I think it's a combination of factors. You mean, in terms of herbicide development, it's very similar to antibiotic development. So... in terms of when we treat bacterial infections. So a lot of work has been done, and people developed some really good antibiotics, and sort of pharmaceutical companies sort of left it alone for a long time. And that's allowed for resistance to be acquired by the bacterium. So it's very similar in herbicide resistance. People thought that glyphosate was the sort of the silver bullet of herbicides, and it was used heavily and has great success around the world, including Australia. But now we're finding we're getting resistance to this as well as all the other herbicides. And so we need to get back into it from an academic perspective to try to find new modes of action and new targets and new chemical molecules which may bind to a different protein within the plant to have the same herbicidal output in terms of killing the weed. I think it's just something that, we've left alone for a long time thinking that everything's okay.
How critical do you think that is, that we actually do find a new way for these herbicides to operate?
Yeah, I think it's important. So, I mean, I think it works at different levels. So it'll give us another sort of, I guess, way to kill the weed. It'll add to the arsenal of herbicides that we have currently. It'll be a new type. We'll be able to apply it to situations where the weeds in the field have become resistant to everything that is commercially available currently. So it'll be another weapon in that respect. And it'll also allow us to diversify our use of herbicides in terms of treatment strategies and help farmers, give them more options to be able to kill the weeds off rather than having to rely on only a small fraction of herbicides, which eventually will resist. Now, saying that our compounds, in the essence of time, will probably develop resistance, but it just gives us more options and more ways to work with things. And the second prong of the project is to find these new modes of action. We can develop compounds which target different parts of these proteins to elicit these effects. So it just gives us more options.
So what's the time frame from here, Keith?
We have some new targets, which is quite interesting, and we have some new molecules that bind those targets and kill the plant, and they're new targets based upon the current herbicide literature. So it's quite exciting at the moment. So we're just sort of, the students and the postdoctoral fellows are working on those projects, and we're trying to develop some structure activity profiles of the compounds, and also trying to get some, structural information about the proteins to find out how the molecules bind, and that'll allow us to make better molecules based upon those, I guess you'd call them backbones, chemical backbones that have the herbicidal activity.
UWA Associate Professor Keith Stubbs speaking with Joe Prendergast. And his research group has received just over $500,000 for the 3-year study from the Australian Research Council Fund. 7 to 1, cherry growers are calling for consumers, that's you, to keep purchasing cherries into the new year after a late start to the season. The premium cherry season has finally kicked off. That's 10 days later than usual. And while it's looking great in Manjimup, the delayed start means growers have had to turn away customers in their busiest time in the lead up to Christmas. Tyne Logan headed out to Manjimup to see how it's going at the state's biggest cherry orchard, Cherry Lane.
Most important is taste. We have to wait for them until they reach the proper sugar levels before we pick them. Yeah, so that's what we mostly look forward to, yeah. Exactly, samples like this. This is what we want.
All right, so like a medium red, not too dark?
Yeah. Some varieties, we have to wait till they go virtually black you know, to when they get their sugars, and they have varieties like Simone and Lappin's. Yeah, the darker they are, the more sugar they've got in them. Well, hi, I'm George Crusaders, owner and operator from Cherry Lane Fields of Management. We've got a massive order to do before Christmas. I don't know how we're going to fill it, but we'll, you know, I'm just driving around the orchard trying to find, or you know, checking varieties for ripeness, and trying to keep the backpackers happy to keep moving and keep picking.
Are you relieved that it's finally started?
Yeah, sort of, yeah, but I'll be relieved after Christmas if I fill these orders, yeah.
And you were saying, you know, just having the rain on the cherries can cause damage to them.
Yes, it can. Yeah.
How have they fared? There was a lot of rain.
We haven't lost anything. Over the weekend we had, I think it was about 12 millimetres of rain over 2 days or so. It was 4.8 one day, and there was about, oh, I don't know, 7 the next. All weekend I just stayed on the blower. We had a variety that was just coming on, and they are very, very susceptible to splitting, but I just continually kept on blowing the water off, and we actually saved the crop.
Well done.
It was a lot of hard work.
And speaking of hard work, your hand picking, or
yes,
your back,
well,
the back
everything
picking,
has to be hand picked. We can't do it any other way.
How many tons?
Well, probably might end up with about 85 to 90 tons this year. Yeah, hopefully. I'm only quoting on what we picked last year. Probably about 10 ton more than last year. But every season's getting bigger and bigger and bigger because we've got more varieties coming on.
In the lead up to Christmas, that would be your busiest time of year. What happens after Christmas?
We're just waiting. I actually got some market agents coming through during this week to organise some export, to try and export something in between Christmas and New Year. But that's not going to be the problem. We still can move a lot of cherries, you know, to the local market. It's not a problem.
Do sales drop off a bit after Christmas?
They do. Actually, they get a bit stagnant till, you know, into the New Year, and then they start moving again. Yes, yeah.
What would you like to see from now on then?
A lot of sun. A lot of sun and warm days. It actually brings them on.
How do you eat your cherries? Is it just fresh that you like, or what would be the best recipe that you'd recommend come Christmas time?
I can't recommend a recipe because I don't eat them.
Don't you?
No, I don't.
You don't like them?
I'll eat a few, you know, just to, you know, when I have to check for taste and that. That's about it, but I'll never, you know, I'm not a sweet person. I just don't like sweet things, you know.
Well, how's that? It's kind of like the barista who doesn't like coffee.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, yeah.
Can we really trust a man, a cherry picker, who doesn't eat cherries? No, I'm sure we can. That was Manjimup cherry grower George Grisotis having a chat with Tyne Logan about the late season in Manjimup, and apparently Mount Barker has been a late start as well. 3-1, and a check-in with the final cattle sales for the year in just a moment. But first, some live export news. Northern cattle producers are ending the year on a high, with feeder steers shipped to Indonesia via Darwin jumping to $3.25 a kilo for the first time this year. The last few months of 2018 has seen a surge of live export shipments from Darwin, which is expected to go over 400,000 head exported for the calendar year. That's well up on last year's total of about 308,000. Feeder steer prices for the Indonesian market bottomed out at about $2.60 per kilo earlier this year, before recovering in August and returning to the $3 mark. Nationwide, the live cattle industry has already gone over that 1 million head mark exported for 2018, with export numbers from January to November sitting at 1,007,805 head. So some good news for live export cattle producers. Now, final check into markets for the year, and today's trader sale in Mount Barker was cancelled. So Tracy Kilner joins me with the details from yesterday's weaner sale. 1,160 head were yarded. Tracy, what were the prices like in Mount Barker yesterday?
Steer calves eased 5 cents on the heavier weights, with feedlot buyers very quiet, while the lightweight steer calves gained 10 cents with good demand from restockers, selling to a top of 320 cents a kilo. Heifers eased on all categories, with the lightweight calves hard to sell. extra heavy over 380 kilo steer calves sold for 220 to 284 cents to average 261 cents, while the heifers made 256 cents a kilo. Steer calves weighing 330 to 380 kilos sold from 270 to 302 cents, while the heifers made 220 to 276 cents a kilo. The 280 to 330 kilo category saw steers sell for 250 to 320 cents, while the heifers made 220 to 276 cents a kilo. Lightweights under 280 kilos sold from 282 to 320 cents, averaging 303 cents for the steers and 182 to 254 cents for the heifers. Bull calves under 450 kilos sold to live export for 252 to 270 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for that, Tracy. That's it for the Country Hour today. Thanks so much for joining me this week. I'll be back with you from midday on Monday, Christmas Eve. If you're driving this weekend, please be safe. Hope you can join us on Monday morning ahead of Christmas Day. But that's it for us this week. It's time for the news. We're coming up to 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.